God.
Exactly.
That's tragic.
Welcome to Shipwreck.
Welcome to Shipwreck. We finally did Alice in Wonderland. I feel like this has been, like, in our pocket. That's gross. I shouldn't say that. This has been, like, on our short list since we started. So gross. Sorry. I'm, like, the queen of, like, accidental, like, doublespeak. Like, I don't even know. I do it all the fucking time. Like, while hosting, I never catch it. I never do it on purpose either. Anyway, this has been on our short list since we started the show. And we kept pushing it off because we were like, at some point, a movie's going to come out. Well, it did. Only no one was paying attention because Johnny Depp is a human pile of garbage. So, yeah, you want to... We don't need to do anything else, right? I'm Amy. You're Casey.
I'm Casey.
I'm Amy. You got some beer. I got some whiskey. We're here at the Booksmith. If you hear any some shuffling or random stomping around, it's because we record live at Booksmith, which is an independent bookstore in the Upper Haight where the show is run on first Thursday of every month. See, like, I got all the information there in one sentence.
Look at you.
Try and stop me.
Here's your one chance, fancy.
So, you know, bear with us as we clunk through this whole thing, but we usually make it work.
Yep. So let's just get right into it.
So let's get into it. So first up, we got the Cheshire Cat. He's like the pink smiley guy that was like on every single item that Hot Topic sold, like, sure, between the 1995 and 2005, roughly. Mm-hmm.
That feels good.
The Pharaoh peered into the hole. Well, I'll be damned. Right behind the wall where his throne stood, there was a fissure between the bricks that had a small furry face inside it. I'm not going to hurt you, little buddy. Come out. Want a grape? Grapes were the top of the food chain and showed how 1% this pharaoh was to use them as a mousetrap. Multiple plagues had spread across the land from overseas traders. The pharaoh would have had decapitated them if it didn't seem redundant. Their oozing sores and blistered skin were worse punishment than any swift death a blade could elicit. Blood had run through the city streets before, but never this much blood, mixed with pus and mucus and gross stuff. No foreigners or peasants were allowed inside the palace walls for fear of contagion to the royal party. The pharaoh had already lost family to the scourge and considered conducting mass suicide amongst his inner circle to preserve some sense of dignified order. Yet, here was a rodent, easily penetrating his deepest levels of security. No court epidemiologist had made the connection between the rodents and the boils yet, but now he began to wonder, his preoccupied mind losing track of the bait in hand. The varmint poked his head out of the crevice and made a mad dash for the grape, snatching it out of the pharaoh's grasp. "Guards, seize that thing!" he yelled to the henchmen, but the mouse dodged through their sticks and knives, scurrying across the floor. Fruit held tightly in its tiny, tiny mouth. As it rounded a corner out of sight, the pharaoh heard a piercing screech, and then silence. Out of nowhere, a cat padded into the chamber, with the mouse between its teeth, head straight forward to the pharaoh. "I come bearing gifts," it initiated with its eyes, a delightful writhing, half-dead gift in its mouth. "Oh, Bastet," the pharaoh exclaimed. "You truly are gifted with the hunt, a fierce warrior and nurturer." The cat promptly turned 180 degrees, waving its sinewy butthole in the pharaoh's face. Browned like a crunchy scrunch, like a brown scrunchy baked in the sun. Browned like a brown scrunchy baked in the sun. It let the mouse go for a brief moment. It twitched back to life and made a break for the freedom of the air ducts. The beast pounced on it once more, toyed with it for a minute, and then tore the mouse's head clear off, spewing its innards across the floor. It then batted the headless corpse around erratically, expecting it to suddenly escape, reanimated. "Our savior! How can I repay you?" The pharaoh knelt before the beast, his guards following suit. To everyone's surprise, the cat looked up at them and said, "Have you seen my balls?" The cat had very square teeth for a carnivore, and it appeared to be smiling. Creature, I know not what you ask for, the cat continued. It's just, I tend to take leave of myself. It's hard to keep track of where now is. As pieces of its body vanished from sight, a head remained. A bit scattered, don't you know, I really must keep it together. I swore I left it somewhere here. The head glided down the hall. The pharaoh followed. What matter of befoulment, he asked incompletely. He was overcome by the urge to attack the floating head, although it aroused a stirring in him. I have had many names through the ages, and I take many forms, such like your boy there. The floating head motioned towards the statue of Anubis, the wolf-headed guardian of the dead. Our kind live on in ancient stories. We live on in lore and on graphic t-shirts and, you know, a lot of hang-in-there posters. The cat head faded away, and a floating dentata was all that remained. The sandpapery tongue would make a quick work of human genitals, the pharaoh found himself thinking. Yes. My kind, we have very distinct genitalia. Very spiky. Like opening an umbrella indoors. It tends to mangle things. Since I lost my balls, I've lost my mojo. As a pan-dimensional being spreading my mutant seed across millennia, losing scrotal motivation, a.k.a. scrotivation, has left me a bit mad. The smile rotated in a slow, angsty spiral, the teeth, tongue, and gums suspended in midair, continuing on. Barbaric practice, this lopping off of balls. We were symbols of fertility and cunning, but the act of castration makes us fat and lazy, prone and inclined towards lasagnas. The pharaoh understood, sort of. He castrated his servants so none could impregnate his queen, and the lineage would remain pure. The court eunuchs had bloated a bit, but remained loyal. The queen had been standoffish lately. Come to think of it, just as the cat had started coming around, and he had warned her not to feed the thing or pamper it, the very sense of blue balls that the cat described struck home with the pharaoh's current situation. No children had been sired, and he missed her non-sandpaper tongue. The queen's, that is. What is lasagna? The pharaoh asked. Ha, lasagna. Well, it's like, you know, the opposite of Mondays. A dish the Romans will eventually perfect. You've had Italian food, yes? I don't require physical sustenance, but I still enjoy the taste. Have you sampled the rat blood yet? I'll pass, the pharaoh said. Where else have you traveled? Oh, I rather enjoyed the 1800s England. They love dairy and wordplay. And Japan, we run train stations there. I have a neighbor, his name is Totoro. In the new continent, millennia from now, they put my face on little pieces of paper that they lick with their moist human tongues. It's called tripping balls, not that I can relate. There was more that he chose not to share with this man-child who played at being king. The pharaoh had a title, yes, but the cat was eternal. Archetypal. The cult of Bastet would grow and his temples filled with worshippers. The same type of people throughout history found themselves compelled to the cat god. He was a fertility symbol, which was ironic since most worshippers were past their reproductive prime. Entering dotage where feline companionship was preferable to that of other humans, they tended towards baby talking to surrogate infants of another species. All worshippers rendered cat likeness in graven images, hieroglyphic, then pictograph, and then the YouTubes. It symbolized an aloof disdain, an indifferent omnipotence, much like other gods had. The cat sighed. Then he hacked violently for 3 minutes, coughing up a neon furball. Well, they're not here. Can I ask you for one favor before I depart? Yes, of course. I owe you for saving our inner sanctum. I've got these glands. They're called glands, or sometimes anal glands. If I'm backed up enough, I need to have them manually discharged. Can't you do that yourself? Ask the pharaoh. Well, it's one thing that I found human hands quite useful for. No claws and all, you see. The cat's butthole appeared directly in front of the pharaoh's face, wriggling towards him, tail aloft. It would really be a great help. I was scooting my butt across the desert sand while we were talking, but it just clumps up the works, you know. The pharaoh sighed reluctantly. Should I use, like, gloves or something? Oh, look, it's not sexual. It's just something I need to express. But no gloves. I need to feel it. The pharaoh would succumb to the plague within 5 rotations of the sun. The end.
And that was The Cheshire Cat, as written by George Chen, who we have lost.
Sort of. We like half. He like half lives in LA and half lives here, but he does like storytelling and stand up, and you should definitely look him up because he's amazing. So next up, we have The Caterpillar, which I kind of feel like we couldn't not do because we are based on Hate Street, and there would have been like some kind of like hookah-based revolt if they could have showed up. I don't know. I just kind of feel like he's in like every store window on Hate Street, at like on every head shop.
Hey, man, you're too good for the Caterpillar, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, no one, I don't have time for that. So we included him.
Finally, the Caterpillar mumbled to himself as Alice left. Fucking whiny ass white girls. He took one last inhale from his hookah before inserting it back up into his anus and prepared himself for bed. Times had been tough for the Caterpillar. He had grown more curmudgeonly in his old age, and his drug problem, although very cool, had become all-consuming. There were only 2 things he truly wanted in life: to blossom into a beautiful butterfly and to get his fuck on. However, at this stage, the Caterpillar had given up hope of ever filling the empty hole in his soul with a soul in his hole. He took one last anal bong hit and began to drift off. Just as his eyelids started to droop, he heard a rustling in the garden. There, through the dark, quivering blades of grass emerged a dodo. The 2 stared at each other for a moment before the dodo whispered, "Psst, you bought him, Steve?" The Caterpillar was like, "What? Are you Bottom Steve?" No. Oh, I meant to be meeting somebody here. We're going to Krusty Cavities. The Caterpillar was intrigued. Krusty Cavities? As in teeth? No, my dear. As in buttholes. Krusty Cavities. You've never heard of it? It's a beautiful, wonderful place. A place for creatures from far and wide. Gather to pleasure each other in all sorts of fun and horrifying ways. You ever want a rim job from a raccoon? You got it. You want to freeze your turd and use it as a dildo on a dodo? You got it. You want a nice Cobb salad? You got it, because they also have food there, dude. It's pretty fucking great. The Caterpillar was speechless. All this time, he'd be looking for a key to unlock his baser instincts, and, as it turned out, the key was firmly lodged in Krusty Cavities. The dodo took pity on the old caterpillar. "Listen, looks like Bottom Steve stood me up. You want to come?" "Me?" asked the caterpillar. "No, your shit-covered hookah pipe. Of course you." The caterpillar's mind began to whirl. Krusty Cavities sounded intimidating, but what if it was his only chance at Rumpy Pumpy? The dodo grew impatient, like, "Hello? Yo, now or never?" The caterpillar nodded. "Let's do this." They arrived at Krusty's around midnight. The caterpillar expected a giant wrought iron gate, but instead found himself in front of a tiny wooden door. His nerves started to fray. The dodo, angsty to get into Krusty cavities, knocked on the door. I can't do it! I'm going back! The caterpillar cried. Jesus, what the fuck is it now? Muttered the dodo. I can't! I didn't tell you this before, but I'm a virgin. A crotchety old virgin. I don't have any business being in a sex club. The dodo had grown tired of the caterpillar shit. Okay, honey, like, first of all, it's not just a sex club. Dude, I told you they did food in there. And, like, calm down. They have shuffleboard. There's shit to do. Second of all, this may be your only chance to, like, experience true happiness. Let's look at the fact. You're old. You're not a butterfly. And the only person you really talk to is that chick Alice. And we all know that bitch Cray. It's time to get fucked or die fucking. Before the caterpillar could respond, a voice came from behind the door. Password. The dodo sighed. Ugh. You are hard, Father William, the young man said. And your pubes have become very white. And yet you insist on giving me head. Do you think at your age this is right? The door flew open. And the caterpillar was immediately engulfed by the sights, sounds, and smells of crusty cavities. Inside, the place was enormous and opulent, like if Buckingham Palace had sex with a sex club. A fuckingham palace, if you will. Oh, yes, you will. There were turtles going down on hares, unicorns pegging lions, and a rat king situation, but instead of entangled tails, penises. Every creature in the land was here and getting theirs. There were sheep sucking off horses, snakes erotically asphyxiating eagles, and a ring of centipedes eating each other's asses, otherwise known as a centipede centipede. Nice. The caterpillar suddenly found himself alone and started to panic. His fuck or flight response kicked in. But as he went to leave, a familiar floating face blocked his pass. Cheshire Cat, what are you doing here? Don't you know, chortled the Cheshire Cat, I own this place. The caterpillar scoffed. Makes sense. I should have known you'd be into this stuff. I'll have you know that I originally wanted Krusty's to be a bed and breakfast. But it turns out, y'all are nasty, so here we are. Just then, a bear sidled up next to them. Sup, Cheshire? Who's this giant turd? Why, this is my friend, the caterpillar. Nice to meet you. My name's Bear. Bear by name, bear by nature. Rawr. You know, caterpillar, bear has a thing for feet. Damn right. Sure, I fucked all the centipedes, but I'm bored of them now. Whereas you, you're fresh meat. Fresh meat. Fresh feet meat. Give me that sweet feet meat. The Cheshire Cat flashed his famous shit-eating grin. Go on, caterpillar. Now's your chance. Bear led the caterpillar to the center of Krusty's and proceeded to unravel the caterpillar's years of sexual repression. There were feet in every possible orifice. Asshole, pee hole, ear hole, eye hole, nose hole, anywhere you could stick something, a foot was stuck there. The caterpillar writhed around in pure ecstasy, filled with euphoria and bear cum. It wasn't long before their antics caught the attention of the other creatures, just like every sex club. Everyone stopped what and who they were doing and gawked in awe. Slowly, the animals formed a jerking circle and began masturbating furiously over the pair of perverted podiatrists. Chickens were choking it, monkeys were spanking it, and lizards were absolutely milking it. The caterpillar looked out into the crowd and saw all these beautiful, contorted faces looking back at him. His eyes started to well up with emotion. Among other things, this wasn't just sex. This was love. The floor shook as the creatures readied themselves for a simultaneous climax. There was a brief moment of silence. And then, boom. A volcanic eruption of cum rose through crusties and blew a hole straight up through the roof. The ejaculations were magnificent and synchronized, like a jizzy Bellagio fountain. And as the liquid pearls rained down on him, the caterpillar opened his mouth to catch the falling cum flakes on his tongue. He could die happy now, but he wasn't done yet. A unicorn beckoned. The caterpillar knew what to do. He mounted the magical beast, took a deep breath, and then slowly crawled gently into the unicorn's butthole. The unicorn reared up onto its hind legs, furiously kicking and bucking. All of a sudden, it let out a symphonic wail, and from its ass emerged not a caterpillar, not a butterfly, but a dazzling winged vagina. The crowd of animals cheered as the vagina flapped its labia and flew off through the cum-wrecked roof. The bear looked up to the sky and said, "Away, my sweet vagifly. Away. You are free now." The animals all stood in stunned silence. The Cheshire Cat walked out to the middle of the club, cleared his throat, and addressed his patrons. "Cobb salads are on the house."
That was The Caterpillar by Amanda Rosenberg. Amanda Rosenberg.
Amanda will be back next month on July 7th because she had to skip June, but she is going to come back and defend her title. And that's in like, what, 3 weeks?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So next up, we got Bill the Lizard. Bill the Lizard, I remember when I was a kid, like by far my favorite. I was like obsessed with it. The Lizard has like two lines in the movie. Mm-hmm. I was obsessed with him.
Yeah.
"Break the toll house gate. Rebecca, let your children possess the gate of those who oppress us. Mine owners slink into their pits, and the English priest who preaches obedient slaves hides in a pond. 20,000 cascade as the black mountain of coal, slurry that devoured Afriban, the republic of social justice is at hand. Soldiers rank on rank, phalanx of eager rifles, unanimous sigh and fall, tumbling down, down the hollow. Who thought they'd shoot with such delirious abandon?" In the subjugated silence, two sullen prisoners skulked in opposite corners of the coal-blackened gall, as if the worst punishment were shared space with social indifference. "Pui Dutch Chin?" The first addressed the newcomer, clear eyes burning under a cloth cap. From his rattling cough, he'd been stirring molten ore in the ironworks since he could peep over the crucible rim. "Come, Reig," spat the other, haughtily, a half-drowned scholar with long, fragile fingers, who looked more at home in a sanatorium than a revolution. Still, their spirit. He was shot off two pistols when they dragged them in. "And they call you educated," the ironworker scoffed, patting his pockets for phantom fags. Ignoring him, the scholar paced. "Yes, and a fine waste that was. It's great to fill your head with liberal ideas, but try to implement them and they shoot at you." Doffing his cap, the ironworker scratched his smoke-stained hair. "You think you're the first to conscript poor folk for the revolution? When I was a boy, I drenched an apron in cow's blood with the strikers. We raised the red flag for freedom. Then the English hanged an innocent boy like a side of veal." The scholar massaged his lily throat as if loosening the noose. "But with your dosh," the ironsmith continued, "maybe all your hide will suffer is a tongue lashing. They've even given you a posh cell. No murderers here, just, you know, drunkards and sodomites." Unconvinced, the scholar inquired with a cruel twisted lips, "And what are you, drunkard or sodomite?" The ironsmith's gaze raked him, ear to foot, like a rabbit hanging from a butcher's hook. "I'm Glynn." Laugh fragmented to crackling cough, And don't worry, I'm chased as a dead dingo's donger tonight. They round up the easy pickings whenever the students establish a new republic. Makes the law look like it's doing its job. Glynn offered his flask, which the scholar drank variously. Tastes like cream sherry? Single malt whiskey? Bitter brewed in a barrel with a dead fox? And heartily sipped more. Courage quickened, he offered. And by the way, my Christian name is George. The ironsmith grinned like a cat, if cats grinned, that is, as George settled shoulder to shoulder. Sensing the scholar brooding over a traitor's death, Glynn said, "You know, on nights like this, my gran, God rest her soul, told the stories. Every Sunday, we'd belt-throat sore Methodist hymns for like 3 hours, and the minister preached fierce about the evils of drink and buggery. Wouldn't you know those are the only two comforts in the valleys? Anyway, after my gran gathered the whole village in the kitchen for her two-room mining cottage, it would be pissing rain outside, but you'd see the fire on the horizon from the ironworks. Gran would light a cigar, drink her cream sherry, and say, 'Gan vim man, mi golways chwedel,' which is, 'I heard my mother tell a tale in a country called Wonderland,' which is very different from Wales, because animals could talk. But not so different, because they'd usually talk down on ya. There was a poor chimney sweep named Bill, who happened to be a lizard. One sultry day, the officious white rabbit, 'Sirrah, extrude this monster from my chimney,' said. Now lizards have the same reservation about monsters as you or me, but the rabbit was the queen's herald, so Bill the lizard obeyed with an 'At your service, governor!' Bill doffed his cotton shirt and buffed up the shaft. And that monster gave him such a kick with her boot, blackened heel, that he shot him into the sky. Higher and higher, past the teetering treetops and a pigeon clucking about serpents. And he'd not but lizard soup on impact. But suddenly, a petit fours, inscribed with a neat pink 'Eat Me,' buzzed past on sugar gossamer wings. With one flick of his clever tongue, you know, since he's a lizard, he plucked that sweet from the sky and ate it like prayer. Bill's neck and legs distended taffy-like, and he thought, 'Quah, the bearded lizard Jehovah ain't so big!' Bill grew so large, he sat among the stars, who sang, 'You may wish upon a star, but you won't get very far.' Yet still, Bill swelled until the stars sank iron hot into his scales. And he straddled all that was, which was saddle-shaped, you know, great Yesimar. Giddy from either drink or martyrdom or attraction, the header four wilting scholar, tiger-like, pinned Glynn to the dirt, straddling his chest. 'So this is the divine design?' Handedly reversing the pin, Glynn declared from his mount, 'It's a new republic, workers on top.' Then kissed George, rough, with bitter aniseed breath, planting a scarlet flag in his throat. Taking no quarter, tearing cotton for no draw and quarter, George canvassed bare throat skin, scrubbed clean as Whitsunday, and Glynn's swollen finger joints strummed George's nub and fissure. Chord of diminished sigh and fall, tumbling down, down, earth in his hair, and rakishly unlaced breeches, Glynn continued with the story. Sitting on that saddle was exalting, but so lonely. Astride all creation, tapered tail sunk into knot and narrowing knot, a bottle marked 'Drink Me' popped into the ether. So Bill the lizard drank and drank. He dismounted the saddle, waved farewell to the stars, the pigeon, the cracked cucumber frame of the rabbit's kitchen garden. But he continued to shrink into a jungle of grass and down again with marbles bumping together and further still until he was all long strings, chords of an upright piano. At the crux of a spider's web, the little vibrations of souls miles away shuddered through him. The caterpillar's mandibles sucking his hookah, a raven, or was it a writing desk, producing few notes and all flat in him, of him, tail tip to claws, balls to lungs, every scale singing in million part harmony, and a manner of speaking, he came without fall or end. But coming is just an echo of what you hear in the quiet. The furtive night held its breath, and the air hummed, swollen and achingly alive. George wept. I'm no martyr. I'm weak and scared, and apparently now a damned sodomite. Glenn dabbed a finger in George's tears. Then maybe you're not a martyr. Maybe this one time, God's calling a sodomite to live. Gathering George to his chest, between shallow breaths, he sang softly an ancient lullaby. He non blentin arv ye mon wes cleed a chanes un you han. And under that breast, the song coalesced to an embodied tune, the tune beyond hearing, too often forgotten, yet always on the tip of the tongue. The room exhaled and swelled, earth floor vast as the Brecon beacons, and strings unbound to any frame quivered with no fall and no end. The Chartists' sentences were commuted from death to transportation. But when the soldiers came, the cell was empty, but for a flask inscribed, Theod Imi, which means, drink me.
And that was Build a Lizard, as written by Damian Ledbetter. An incredible writer.
Who apparently actually speaks Welsh.
Yeah. Or learned enough of it.
Like, learned enough of it that he speaks it, you know, conversational Welsh.
All this, I will say that everything on his resume intimidates me.
Oh my God, me too. Me too.
Theology.
And he's like traveling in
gender studies. He's across, not even in the country right now.
Because he's in Wales.
Yeah.
Speaking conversational Welsh. It's amazing. There are just some people who just make me feel bad about myself, and he is one of them. I think that's just.
But he is also super sweet. So it's like.
I know.
What are you going to do? Yeah. We feel bad about our lack of accomplishments, but he's like, these people are just great and they run the best.
Yeah, I know. And you're like, great, now I'm a monster as well.
Love you, Damien.
So next up we have the Queen of Hearts. She's what the other 50% of the Hot Topic merchandise was, generally. Is that real? But there wasn't as much.
And that
there
song.
Was some. The yeah, there was a song. Yeah. You're just gonna do karaoke the whole entire song. Can that be like the fade out music, please? You have to do that.
Okay. Her Majesty. 'Twas mid-noon when playing card 7 walked towards the rose garden and stumbled upon 3 playing cards all in a hurry. 5 held a ladder while 2 carried a pail of red paint quite poorly in his white gloved hands. 6 seemed to lack purpose and was neither assisting with the precarious ladder nor assisting with the spilling bucket. Poor creatures, pondered 7, absentmindedly. At any rate, I don't want to dally, he muttered, continuing on. 7 continued to walk along the perimeter of the royal garden. To the west, a labyrinth of green spread as far as the eye could see, and along its twisting paths popped thousands of crimson roses. 7 stopped distracted by a larger-than-usual dandelion. Sprawled on her throne, the queen's influence reached as far as he ever dared thought. Or was it think? He couldn't be sure. And, realizing how much time he had wasted, he picked the dandelion and tossed it onto the stone steps and hurried on. 7 couldn't remember what exactly he had done to anger the queen. Whatever it was, must have been terrible. The Queen of Hearts was famous for her temper. He knew, and for her to call him so far from the barracks and alone, it was too much to puzzle over, and his mind retreated to a poem he learned while studying in the Academy of Hearts. How doth the little cock improve its shining trail and pour the seeds out from its mouth on women soft and pale? How gleefully it seems to thrust, how stately and so tall, then lovingly darts back again into that place enthralled. He was sure he had got it all wrong somehow, which bothered him a great deal, and presently he came upon the foreboding heart-shaped door. "Today is very odd, I should think," said Seven to the stately pair of threes posed as doormen. A stern nine opened the large heart-shaped door with a heave and walked him down a long hallway. Nine gestured to an intricately carved wooden bench stained a deep cherry red. Seven sat gingerly, staring at the emblazoned gold door of the Queen's chambers. He heard a scuffle, and at his feet stood a dormouse wearing a small silk hat and fine vermilion velvet livery. The mouse brandished a miniature gold horn, with which he let out the smallest of toots.
"Her Royal Highness, the Queen of Hearts will see you now,"
he chirped.
"Woo!"
The heavy doors opened, and Seven stepped timidly into the Queen's... This guy's red. I love you. The heavy doors opened, and Seven stepped timidly into the Queen's dimly lit chambers. As he entered the room, Seven passed a stone pillar just his height, upon which sat a golden key with a heart stamped into its top. Red furs were draped across couches and over the bed and all the way to the glowing hearth. Seven peered into the shadows and saw the King of Hearts tied to a chair in the corner, wearing only his long johns. Alas, he had a red cloth gag shoved firmly in his mouth, and a small little cock was visibly hard through his shabby long johns. Suddenly, the Queen appeared on his right. Or perhaps was there all along? "Get on your knees," the Queen demanded. Playing card Seven trembled violently, his paper rustling as he extended a white-gloved hand to steady himself on the stone wall. "If it pleases your majesty," Seven looked down. The Queen's eyes burned in the dark, catching the flicker of the fire from the hearth as she strode to the pillar with the key, and flashing quick smiles, stuck the key in the hole and locked the chamber doors. "You are not attending," barked the Queen. She stood directly in front of Seven, and reaching down, she grabbed his right corner and pulled him to his feet. She slowly extended her bejeweled hand and softly traced the curls of his ornamentation. "Ugh, no one has ever touched my ornamentation before." he gasped, feeling the edges of his paper curl. "Hold your tongue," the Queen thundered as she grabbed his gloved hands and held them above his head. "From the moment you were but pulp from a tree, you were mine, and your fellow soldiers are mine. This whole kingdom is mine, and you are but a pathetic piece of paper." The Queen of Hearts' massive breasts heaved, and she pulled his face right into them. Seven had never felt such admiration for her raw power. The curve of her bicep, clearly visible through the lace of her gown, left him weak. Running his tongue down the Queen's ample cleavage, he mused to himself, "Things really have gone quite queer today. But oh, are they awesome." Her breasts strained in their red velvet casing. The Queen bent down and gently pulled up the folds of intricate fabric, exposing her blushing thighs. "Lay down," the Queen said. Seven willingly obeyed, and the Queen exposed her ginormous rump. Seven slowly poked his small pink tongue out of his paper lips. The Queen's royal rump loomed. As she crouched into a squat, her rump swelled as if the skin itself was stretching to its limits, exposing the royal rosebud. The Queen screamed in ecstasy as she rode Seven's little face into a beastly orgasm. She fell to his side, exhausted, and an evil grin spread across her face. "Bring the flamingos!" "Get them over here," she growled. The king cowered in his chair, his throbbing little cock a constant reminder of his lack of power and admiration for his queen. Seven exchanged a quizzical look with the king. A four came into the room from a door hidden behind a dresser and lugged a golf bag with three pink flamingos crammed into its leather mouth. Seven scrambled to his feet, and the four handed him a large flamingo by its webbed feet. The queen got on all fours and once again presented her rear to Seven. She violently masturbated and spread her legs wide. The flamingo twisted itself around and peered directly into the face of Seven with such a dreadful look, Seven could barely muster the strength it took to hoist his gangly body about. The flamingo looked between Seven and the queen. Seven and the queen. And realizing what lay in store, let out a joyous squawk and a laugh. Seven delivered a steady and resounding swoop to the jiggling, flushed ass of Her Majesty the Queen of Hearts. It was all very uncomfortable. With a second swoop, Seven managed to stir up a great deal of pink feathers. The flamingo made a valiant attempt to remain still, and with one webbed foot in the crook of Seven's arm and the other held in his mouth, Seven delivered a final paltry blow. The queen came hard, squirting and screaming, and writhed among the furs on her floor. Seven sat down on a draped chair, exhausted, and released the bird. Everything was wet. They were dripping and uncomfortable and all out of sorts. Feathers covered every imaginable surface, and yet, reflected Seven, one really mustn't say they don't like a thing before trying it, for one might as well try a thing before deciding if it disagrees with him or not. The end.
And that was The Queen of Hearts, as written by Eden Temple.
Lots of first-time writers on this one. Really? It was 4 out of 6 first-time writers.
The first show. I mean, we were really invested in this one, too.
We really were. So next up is the Mad Hatter, and I'm gonna say this in the podcast because apparently this is a thing that I knew, but that, like, not everybody knows. I just assumed this was common knowledge, but we were just talking about this, and I guess it's not. So the Mad Hatter is mad because at the time that this book was written, there was mercury in the glue that they used to make hats and keep them together and whatever, whatever. So, like, hatters, I guess everywhere, were just, like, slowly going crazy, and nobody knew why, because they were, like, getting mercury poisoning. Because it can, like, seep through your skin and shit.
Who knows?
Yeah. And then we were also just talking, so the March Hare isn't on our character list, but, and you don't have to include this, but just, so the March Hare is the way he is because March is mating season for rabbits, so he's not just, like, a crazy, like, goofy rabbit guy, like, he's, like, he's horned up! Like, he's horned up. So that's those guys. That's why they're crazy together and hanging out together.
The more you know.
Now you know. So Mad Hatter.
Hatter began his design career young, showing up to the third grade in the finest coats made of his mother's finest drapes. This sat well with neither his peers nor his mother. In college, things got easier. Men could do things like study theater and art and ballet, and people would just sigh and shake their heads instead of giving them wedgies. And he realized that his passion for fashion wasn't just for the traditional head. He was a haberdasher of the cock. A fashionista of the phallus. A stylist of the schlong. And what cunning chapeaux he devised. A top hat for those formal occasions, some distinguished fedoras for the sophisticated man about town, and one of his classics, a raincoat. Okay, I think I'm going to stand, actually. Because dynamic. Soon. Maybe. We'll see. He expanded his repertoire to include cravats and flatteringly tailored waistcoats. Why should women get all the lingerie? No, indeed. The masculine form was infinitely preferable and far more compelling, those weird, lumpy female bodies, and he was going to celebrate it and clothe it as its glory deserved. He attempted to model his ensembles himself, but it proved difficult to produce a quality portfolio of dick pic selfies. As any man who uses Tinder needs to realize. But then he met an interior design student who called himself Summertime. Some people leave the closet, others march out with an accompanying brass band. Summer was happy to pose in Hatter's creations and make them sing. As their collaboration blossomed, Summer became more flirtatious, his poses more daring, his penis more groomed. Hatter began to feel daring, one day remarking that Summer seemed like he was going to burst out of his brocaded cock coat. When I'm around you, Summer purred, I can barely keep my hat on. Hatter giggled nervously. He was virginal, but there was no denying the way he felt about Summer. He wanted to rip every last piece of clothing off of him, including the silk top hat currently perching pertly on his prick. Summer seemed to know and slithered out of his clothes, only the top hat remaining. Hatter gazed lustfully at his model, knowing that he had found the perfect man. If ever there was a black tie boner, it was Summer's stunning shaft. Summer laced one hand into Hatter's hair and pulled his face close. I want you, he breathed, his lips millimeters away, to make the hat come off without touching it. Hatter thought his knees might give out when Summer kissed him, his lips hot and sweet, his body firm and muscular and pressing hard against him. Hatter's knees did give out, and he dropped, letting his eyes fall level with the most wonderful wang in the world. He had never been so close to one before, and all he could think was that Summer's pubes were fine and soft. He barely even needed those silk cravats Hatter had styled onto him. His balls were beautiful, their gentle curves inviting a caress of the eyes, the smooth tautness of the skin compelling a hand to hold them and feel their satisfying weight. He gave in to the temptation, his eyes nearly rolling back in his head with bliss at the feel of the balls in his hand. Giving in to instinct and desire, he began frantically licking at Summer's shaft, sucking where he could, fondling his balls, his other hand reaching around to tightly squeeze one supple, curvaceous ass cheek. He moaned with delight as he felt Summer buck with pleasure and his licking intensified. As Summer bucked again and Hatter's legs against went gelatinous, Summer accidentally slid forward, his legs passing around Hatter for a brief moment. His flawless testicles rested softly on Hatter's forehead. Simultaneously cool and hot, causing Hatter to gasp and arch up with delight, his tongue sliding easily into Summer's quivering asshole. For a moment, they were both still, their breaths drawn in simultaneously pleasure and shock. But then they wordlessly relaxed into it, Hatter's tongue moving as deftly and deliberately around the crown of the anus as his hands normally did around the crown of a cock hat. Finally, consumed by the urgency of his desire, Hatter stood up and grabbed Summer's hips. Like threading a needle, he easily slid his delirious dick into Summer's spit-rimmed ass and began rhythmically pumping. In short order, both artisan and model were screaming in delight. Just as Hatter felt he couldn't contain himself anymore, the top hat shot off the tip of Summer's dick, like cork from a bottle of mishandled champagne, trailing a streamer of glistening jizz behind it. Hatter quivered and gasped and promptly bedazzled Summer's lower back with his own glistening glee juice. Summer looked over his shoulder at Hatter, blinking languidly. I like the cut of your jib. Haberdasher of my heart, he murmured. It was the start of a beautiful relationship. For years after, Summer continued to be model and muse for Hatter, even when they graduated and Summer got a job doing interior decoration at the court of the Queen of Hearts, and cut the Summer off his name and just became Time. He said it was more edgy and made him sound suited for the court of a queen, rather than fairyland. Still, Hatter stayed with him. Their sex continued to be raucous and juicy and full of tiny hats. Until the day that one of the queen's servants saw them. It turns out Summer feared sounding like a fairy because the queen was notably homophobic. That night, as Hatter was performing for the queen's amusement, the servant whispered what had been seen in her ear. That was when she shrieked that Hatter was killing time, and everything went to hell. Hatter fled, desperate to save Summer's career. Once again, he was mad, not crazy, but angry. Why couldn't a man love who he loved, craft caps for cocks, and be happy? He hid his rage in obfuscating banter and impossible riddles, lashing out at the world that had hurt him. His friends tried to comfort him with an afternoon BTSM party. Bowlers, tea, and scrumptious munchies. BTSM. But then that horrid child came and ruined it. They were about ready to give up when she finally left. Hatter fell quiet and despondent again. BTSM parties weren't the same without Summer wearing nothing but a bowler on his boner. Dormouse suddenly chirped in excitement. Hatter looked up, wondering what hair had gotten butter into this time. But there, at the end of the table, stood Summer, wrapped in a beautiful silk robe. "Good afternoon," he said softly. "I heard there was a BTSM party." "Yes," Hatter replied nervously. "I would like to join." "Shouldn't you be at work?" Hatter whispered, choked up. "You haven't a hat," cut in Hare. "Oh, my sweet thing," crooned Summer. "I care about this party too much to show up improperly attired." He unbelted his robe and let it drop, revealing his beautiful body naked, except for a bowler hat at a jaunty angle on the head of his prick. A smile spread across Hatter's face. He was no longer the Mad Hatter, but the Glad Hatter. And he had the erection to prove it. The end.
And that was the Mad Hatter, as written by Ms. P.
Was this like her fourth one in a row?
Yeah, she's doing really good.
Yeah.
She's on a tear. Finally.
All right, last one is the Dormouse. And if you watched the Disney movie as a child, you probably remember the Twinkle Twinkle Little Bat guy. The little mouse that, like, falls asleep inside the tea kettle during the tea party and kind of just, like, speaks in verse all the time, like a total obnoxious twat. That's the Dormouse.
Dormouse is peacefully snoring on stage. As he sleeps, he sings a little tune to himself. "Twinkle, twinkle, little bug, penis is my favorite drug." After a moment or two, he snaps awake, looking guilty. "Oh, it happened again, didn't it? It's not my fault. It's never my fault. Narcolepsy, they call it. When I get too excited, when things get a little too intense, I just fall asleep. They make fun of me for it, too. They use me as an armrest or shove me in the teapot for a laugh. And they don't know the worst of it, not by half. Because, well, of course, I've had sex. I've had great sex, a great deal of tawdry, wonderful sex. I've done needle play with hedgehogs. Oh, and feather play with flamingos. I've done it with the Cheshire Cat who vanishes slowly until there was nothing left but a semen. You know, just like all men. And it's all been..." Pay attention, boys. "And it's all been, well, fabulous. But it's never been enough because I never get to snuggle afterwards. That's it, you see. Narcolepsy. It is the worst. When I get too excited, and when I'm taking a face full of mock turtle soup or pounding the yard-long arse of a caterpillar, I fall asleep. I've never got to lie awake in a love puddle, never brush sweaty hair from someone's eyes. Sex is fine, you know, thoroughly dandy and all that, but I want comfort, too. All I've ever wanted is comfort and a little love. So I decided to talk to them, the Mad Hatter and the March Hare. I mean, my worst tormentors, my kinkiest lovers, my closest friends. I found them at the tea table having an on-birthday party and knocking back opium like sugar lumps. You know how they do. Dormouse, the Hatter cried out. There you are, old fellow. Come and tell us a story. I opened my mouth to reply, but all that came out was a... "Ooh." "He's falling asleep again," crowed the Hare. "Pour tea on his nose. Put butter up his butt." My mouth clamped shut. Then I took a deep breath and I told him a story. the story I just told you. I told them how torn apart I was by sex and sickness, how I ached for caresses, but only ever got cock in my face. They were silent for a long time. Then, and I thought perhaps the laudanum had kicked in, but then the Hatter smiled, and something in me melted.
Dear friend, why didn't you ever say so before? He said. Poor old Dormouse, said the Hare, pouring a little tea. Suffering in silence for so long, and the answer so close after all. What you need is an unorgasm. of course, cried the Hatter. For every orgasm one does have, there are millions and millions of other orgasms one isn't having. And when you have an unorgasm, you experience all of those potential orgasms at once. It's like opening up and letting the whole universe crowd in. And we are going to help you have one. It shall be the greatest unorgasm ever. A very merry unorgasm to you, sang out the Hare. Woo! Well, of course I was excited. I'm excited just thinking about it now, to experience billions of orgasms at once, to lie awake at last in the lover's arms. It all sounded so... The Dormouse becomes so excited during his last line that he abruptly falls asleep again. Gentle snoring ensues, intercepted with snatches of twinkle, twinkle, and perhaps the occasional penis. After a few moments, he snaps awake and clears his throat awkwardly. Well, I woke up strapped to a teacup on the table with the Hatter looming over me. Cup of tea? He inquired. He must have taken a mushroom to shrink himself down to my size. He'd never done something like that for me before. Oh, yes, I replied. Hare, please fetch the tea bag. And the next instant, my mouth was chock-a-block with hairy balls. Milk? Shrieked the Hatter's voice. I said, and a thin stream of milk dribbled down towards my twitching little cock.
Sugar!
Screamed the Hare, and then a spoonful of sugar began to be introduced into my anus. And now, the Hatter's voice reached fever pitch, for the teacup ride! All of a sudden, my teacup began to hurtle about. They must be spinning the tea tray, I thought, as I careened across the table in a shower of crockery. Every so often, I would feel the thwack of a flogger on my chest, and the Hatter's delighted cry, one lump or two! But at last, the mad ride came to an end, and I was flung clear, landing face first on the tablecloth. I was a trifle annoyed with my friends at this point, but then they lifted me up and kissed my bruises, and led me to a teapot in the center of the table. The big one. Hatter moved first, his mouth dancing down my chest to my little mouseketeer. He gobbled me up like a tart, each thrust pushing me back against the teapot until the spout began to nudge its way inside me. The Hare was slathering all six of my nipples with the very best butter. I closed my eyes and gave into each sensation in turn. The Hatter's tongue, a caterpillar grazing on my cock, the Hare flicking and teasing me with all four paws, the spout now buried deep inside me to the hilt, the tea spilling over into me, the warmth. I was coming, but I was receiving. I could feel every orgasm of my existence like a glory of golden afternoons. There was a wonderland inside me. And it grew and grew until I burst open and all the stars came rushing in. They came dancing, hurtling, fucking. And for one incredible moment, I felt like a being of pure energy. Someone who would live forever and never sleep again. I guess what I'm trying to say is I shot jizz all over the cake. When it was over, we curled up on a slice of bread and butter, a lover on either side of me. Hatter laid a kiss on my brow, sweet and mad as mercury. The Hare nuzzled my ears. This is all I ever wanted, I said. I'm awake, and you're holding me, and it's magical, and I'm awake! I lay between them, looked up at the stars, and sang, twinkle, twinkle, little bug, penis is my favorite drug. Now that I can stay awake, pound me like a minute steak. Twinkle, twinkle, little bug, just make sure there's time for hugs. The end. Everybody go hug yourselves.
That was The Dormouse, as written by Sarah Stanton. That's been our show.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening.
It's fine.
For the people in the back. We have a live show. If you enjoyed what you heard and you haven't seen us live and you're in the San Francisco Bay Area or, you know, New York at the end of the year, please, please come on out. We have some interesting – we have a Fahrenheit 451 coming up soon.
Well, we have – first we have – we have Da Vinci Code coming up first, and that'll be on July 7th at 7 p.m. at Booksmith. Then – the August show, which is August 4th, is Fahrenheit 451. That's at 7 p.m. at Booksmith.
But before that, our sister show.
Before that, yeah, we have a sister show.
Boat Crash.
Called Boat Crash. No affiliation.
Not a terribly smart sister.
And kind of a dick move, sister.
Like, it was kind of like, it's not really a sister show. You just
literally ripped off our show. So Boat Crash is coming. It's our first ever Boat Crash at Booksmith. We're really excited about it. And it'll be on July 30th, which is a Saturday at 10 p.m. We're doing a little known series. Mm. You probably have never heard of it. But it's called Magic School for Wizard People.
Yeah, it's good, too.
And
you know, when I was a kid, my governess was obsessed.
My governess.
With Magic School for Wizard People.
With Barry Otter.
Of course.
Everyone loves Barry Otter.
With his cloud-shaped star.
Exactly. So we're going to take on Barry Otter and friends on Saturday, July 30th at 10 p.m., leading up to the midnight release of a completely unrelated book in a completely different series that comes out at midnight, which you can buy with your ticket if you are so inclined. Tickets are on sale for that one. You can find it all at booksmith.com/shipwreck. And then... this is the last sales pitch, and we'll shut up. On September 28th, we will be at Public Works in San Francisco for the launch of our first ever Shipwreck anthology. It's called Loose Lips. It's coming out from Grand Central Press. We're super excited about it. And we're going to have a big old giant party at Public Works with special guest reader Cecil Baldwin. And you finally get to hear what kind of incredible filth goes on inside of Baruch's head, because he will be writing. So Baruch's writing. It's going to be disgusting.
I'm honestly terrified
of whatever's going to come out of Baruch's brain.
Baruch's really nice.
Yeah,
I have a feeling he's going to write like a Care Bears or like Rainbow Bright, like crossover.
Yeah, thing. He probably would. Actually, you're right. That does. You know what? Now that you say that, that totally sounds like Baruch.
Like X-Men, Rainbow Bright.
X-Men and Rainbow Bright. Anyway, it's going to be a sight.
Is Alan okay? Because he's texting you like maybe he lives in the kitchen on fire.
He's at a conference in Berkeley, and he's like live texting me like photos of peanut butter and jelly sandwich and stuff, because he's like in a skybox. Look, this is how they serve Chex Mix at the thing he's at. It's been mostly photos of food.
I just really thought like it was going to be a picture of like him and the dog standing next to a fire.
No, it's just like, I just saw the fat squirrel. That was
the last. I love him so much.
I just saw the fat.
It's a dormouse of squirrels.
I never thought he would be texting me, I just saw the fat squirrel.
Anyway, catch you next time. But up, up, chat back.
Fade out to Queen of Hearts. Playing with the Queen of Hearts. Going in it till you're smart. The Joker ain't the only fool who do anything for you. And that was. No, you're thinking of Care Bears.
Star Shard. the phone? Okay. I like that it waits just long enough to make you think it's not going to ring again, and then it rings again.
Okay. I thought it was maybe just Whitney's phone, but they got it downstairs.